morning, DG and your team. Good morning, everybody. My apologies for arriving late. I've just landed now this morning. I don't know, usually do that. I normally arrive on Monday. So today I just had to take the early morning one. But yeah, we are here. So let's start. We will be dealing with environmental programs today. In particular, working for fire program. It's a follow-up to our engagement with the DEA, Dr. Preston and his team. So we have agreed that we must have a follow-up to get briefing on particular aspects that we have asked for. And then later on, we are going to have to adopt the report, BRRR report. I hope that members were able to read through the report and we will be ready to adopt the report. So, okay, let me hand over to the DG to take us through, but let's first deal with the apologies from the minister, the acting minister who will not be able to attend. He is hosting the ministers of tourism for the Indian Ocean Rim Association, which is taking place in Port Elizabeth today. The DM is also not able to attend. Well, there's no reason here. So we don't have an apology for DM. Honorable Gunu has sent an apology. Okay, let's hand over to the DG. Honorable Padden as well. Yes. Okay. All right, DG.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, honourable members. I have the team here to take the committee through the presentation, covering both the legal framework, the arrangements that pertain to the Working on Fire program. How procurement was pursued to get to that point following a feasibility study, and we then get to also deal with the financial report as well as the responses in respect of the management report or the findings of the Auditor General. So I'd like to introduce the team that's here, chairperson, so that as they present, they will follow each other. We have Dr. Preston, Dr. Christo Maray, Mr. Trevor Abrams from Working on Fire, Sandy Sonzomi, Finance, Anil Ekrobla, also Finance, and then we have Salim Mohammed from the CFO.
Who are the people? Okay. We know Dr. Preston and Mr. Abrams.
Dr. Christo Maray. The chief director responsible in the department.
Yeah, we know him.
And then here is Mr. Nsomi.
Mr.
Sandy Nsomi.
Okay.
He is going to take us through the finance. He's the finance manager in Working on Fire. Okay. Together with Anil Strobler, who is behind me, and then here is Salim Mohammed.
So Mr. Strobler is also on fire.
Working on fire, yes.
Okay.
And then Salim Mohammed is in the CFO division of the department,
okay.
And Sbo and myself. And Heinrich Muller is legal, and Dr. Preston will take us through the current legislative framework and supported by Mr. Heinrich Muller. So I would like to then hand over to Dr. Christo Marais, who will then take us through the overview of the arrangements. And then he will be followed by Trevor, and then is it Sandiso? Guy, Trevor, and then Sandiso. Thanks, in that order.
Okay, we have got a big bundle in front of us, so I don't know the exact approach. We have got 2 hours to deal with everything else in here. So if you can just be considerate of that when you do your presentation. How many presentations are you going to have?
It'll be four, Honourable Chair.
For
the overview, and then the legal framework, and then Trevor will do performance and institutional arrangements within Working on Fire, and then Sandiso will deal with the audits, the internal audits in Working on Fire.
Okay.
But we should be able to, we take cognizance of your request, Honourable Chair. We'll try and allow for enough time for discussions and questions.
Direct then the document that's being used now for the presentation. There is a Word document that outlines the legal. After that, there is an overview which is yellow, like what you see on the slide. So we would then take you through that presentation first. Thanks.
Thank you, DG. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, for the opportunity to present to you. The pack that you've got in front of you, the Word document, is basically a more detailed document of the overview presentation. I've just taken extracts from the Word document in order to ensure that you've got detailed information to work on. We've basically received 6 questions to be answered for the portfolio committee. The legal arrangements between DEA and Working on Fire, and that I'm going to touch on, make an introduction, the way the procurement process, etc. The Working on Fire program audit findings, that will be the 2016-17 audit findings by the Auditor General and the internal audit response to that, and then also a response to the 2017-18 audit findings. Honourable Chair, at our last meeting you said we should come up with a process to address the shortcomings that was identified by the Auditor General, and today we're going to attempt to take us forward on that as part of this discussion. Then, Trevor, after my presentation, Dr. Preston will do the legal overview. Then Trevor will deal with the Working on Fire business model, which sort of I referred to in my presentation as well as Sandiso's presentation on the Working on Fire internal audit and detailed expenditure over the last number of years. Then we just a brief feedback on implementing agencies' fees or entities' fees. That's just one slide that I'm going to refer you to. It's an outcome from the consolidated audit by Deloitte. And then a process follows to procure goods and services for 2017-18.
You see, this is, can just go to the substance, you know. To say we are going to do this, we are going to take it through, that's wasting even more time. If you can just go straight to the issues.
Okay.
Yes. Legal arrangements, And then
lastly the turnaround strategy. Then the legal arrangements to start off with, before in 2012 the National Treasury appointed transaction advisors to advise the department on the most appropriate way of dealing with the Working on Fire program. And the objectives of this assessment was to review and confirm the DIA's needs analysis and DIA's options, or the options that we have for the Working on Fire program. What they looked at and what the standard was, or the items were that we, or the services that we needed were supporting of fire protection associations, advocacy, detection and dispatch, ground operations, which is the big one, aerial support, incident command system, capacity building, monitoring, evaluation and research and development. So they needed to look at the feasibility of that. Now, the overall needs analysis confirmed that there were 9 key focus areas. Review and confirm the needs analysis, develop a phased approach of achieving the new refurbishment of the fleet stock specifically. The next slide is then options for the most appropriate technologies to be utilized in refurbishment of fleet stocks. And then there was quite a lot of information emphasis put on the time period of the contract. Options for the institutional arrangements, funding and financing, and again fleet stock came up, development and evaluation of funding options and development and of a matrix against which the various options can be evaluated, and then identifying the preferred options. Transactions advisors then prepared a detailed feasibility study to identify the preferred option. They looked at the appropriate areas for risk transfer, development of a full financial model, demonstrating long-term viability of the project, a plan-phased approach for the procurement of fleet stock, and development of a detailed procurement plan. The risk areas that they looked at in the feasibility was personnel cost, information systems, billing, protective clothing, training, operational, ground fleet transport, and aviation. The assessment of the risks then looked at management fees. At the time, we were paying management fees of 16%. Related parties procurement, additional investment into the program, duplication of resources, improvements to the current program or the current at the time through proper contract management, and analysis of an appropriate term for the program. The feasibility study then came to 8 conclusions. They came to the conclusion that it wasn't a PPP, and I'm going to come back to this again. The minimum period was aligned with capital infrastructure, and it was agreed that and recommended that we follow a 7-year contract. It was suggested that fleet management be dealt with in a full maintenance lease agreement, marketing option be considered because it gives the best of both worlds solution, function be set up to secure donor funding, and an incentive such as profit sharing to be fine third-party business, and a no-interference approach to remuneration of staff, etc., except the EPWP requirements for the workers. And then the legislative framework, which Dr. Preston is going to deal with later on. Now, just as a backup to the legislative framework, Honourable Chair and members, the map that you see in front of you is a map of the fire-prone biomes in South Africa. So fire is both a contributing factor to the health of the biome, or it can have a negative impact on the integrity of the biome through 2 long fire cycles and burning in the wrong season, or 2 short fire cycles also burning in the wrong season. Actions taken by the department then to address the recommendations from the transaction advisors in the feasibility study. Firstly, we then followed a standard supply chain process and with oversight and supervision by National Treasury. Four proposals were received. Although the program wasn't going to be implemented as a PPP, it was decided that a full due diligence as part of the feasibility or using the feasibility and options analysis would be done and was done in the outcome. Then what was then called the FFA Pty Limited was then the successful bidder, was the only bidder that qualified, and was then a contract negotiation started. As I've already mentioned, we've decided then on a 7-year contract, the fleet to be managed in a full maintenance lease program, and the Working on Fire program has developed a very effective communications program, which maybe some of you are on the distribution list with all the videos that you get from time to time. And then unlocking of third-party resources was also a priority. Next slide then. Schedule 12 of the contract or to the contract dealt specifically with unlocking of third-party resources, and which the program has been relatively successful in up to now. With regards to the HR policies, the department had or have representation, and it's increased its representation both in general management of oversight and the general management of Working on Fire, and we're involved in, for instance, the program's engagement with unions in order to ensure that we stick to the EPWP ministerial determination and code of good conduct. And then the legal mandate was identified, and I'm not going to stand still because Dr. Preston is going to do that, but what was also identified and negotiated is that we have to have a proper interaction and collaboration with our key partners, being the Natural Resource Department's Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, who is responsible for the National Felt and Forest Fires Act, the National Disaster Management Center in DECOG, and they are then, and the conservation agencies, and they also sit on the executive committee of the Working on Fire program. So we've got an oversight committee with a number of representatives, and then the executive committee that signs off on the decisions made. Section B, I'm then going to quickly look at the audit findings, I'm going to deal with in 2016-17 and 2017-18. The 2017-18 ones are going to look at more the findings more on the broader NRM programs, so I'm just quickly going to deal with them. In 2016-17, the department then commissioned an internal audit review of the findings of the Auditor General and what we're going to do about it. And I'm going to discuss these quickly with you, Chair. The finding was uncertainty around how the management implementing fee was arrived at. Now, this was part of the negotiation, not the negotiation process, the bidding process. And basically, because we're an EPWP, we would like to maximize employment. So your management costs you want to minimize, you want to minimize your transport costs because those are your major drivers, and these were the aspects that we considered at the management fee. And it was a bit management fee. The management fees, should the budget go up above CPIX, the percentage management fee comes down. Concerns raised around the possible duplications of operations. After detailed analysis...
Sort of management fee, by the way, is what, 16%?
No, the management fee now is 9.6%.
9.6%,
yeah. At the time, the estimate that was of the feasibility study was that we could save 50% on management fee, and we've actually achieved more than that. Then we go to the second one, the concerns raised about the possible duplication. The internal audit then found that after detailed analysis, there was no duplication of functions found in the Working on Fire program. Kashuga Clothing was not approved as a related party, and the omission of fleet management as a related party was a finding of the Auditor General. And there, Honourable Chair, I'm afraid it was an oversight by the negotiators at the time, and we will be. I will come back to the steps that we're taking to deal with that. Concerns were raised. The next slide, then. The concerns were raised regarding the poor quality of PPE. The Working on Fire Management went into this, and the concerns were raised based on comments of a firefighter that responded to said that the clothes are thin. Now, we haven't had any cases where our PPE has failed yet, but the management did engage with us. At the time, the Auditor General was not able to recalculate the amounts that were contained in the contract for monthly repayments. This was gone into detail by the internal audit, and they found substance and evidence that all these fees are in line with Schedule 10 of the MOA. Concerns were raised regarding the finance lease arrangements, and as I already mentioned, we're in the process of drafting, or not drafting, the process, the drafting is already done, it's for legal vetting, and the DG will then submit that to National Treasury to get it, it sorted out. Then the next slide, a concern was raised that the lease agreement is not in line with Schedule 10 of the MOA. As I've already mentioned, this is being dealt with as an addendum. And a review was done of the management fee claimed by Working on Fire in relation to the international engagement. Now, this wasn't a finding of the Auditor General, but it was added to the terms of reference of the internal audit, and the three international deployments, the management fee claimed by Working on Fire was 9.6%, 7% for the second Canadian visit, and 9.1% for the Indonesian deployment. And the internal audit also didn't find any discrepancies. Then we get to the 2017-18 audit and the response, and now I'm going to expand the scope a little bit to the full natural resource management programs. Reporting the, as you will remember from the previous meeting, reporting on implementing entity fees was a concern. Now, the issue of reporting on implementing entity fees was never a concern for Working on Fire. It was a concern for other natural resource management programs, and that is being addressed in the turnaround strategy, which I will deal with at the end of my presentation. The department developed an action plan to amend the financial statements. This process is on its way, and it's basically all that we've been working on since the last meeting, Honourable Chair. So we are full out on our turnaround strategy and to comply with the requirements as stipulated and spelled out by the Auditor General in our last meeting. Concerns were raised around research funded by the department is not represented sufficiently in the financial statements. This was specifically referring to Working on Fire. The only research that Working on Fire do is very specific applied research, like for instance the tick research that we're currently doing on prescribed burning, how you can use prescribed burning to bring tick loads down in nature for animal health purposes. And the second kind of work that we do is we had some socioeconomic problems and we commissioned a socioeconomic studies on female representation, etc., etc. So it's very, very specific to the needs of the program. These research, however, is being presented at the oversight committee and be recorded and implemented accordingly, but it's also being taken up in the NRM database of research. that we use in a broader chief directorate. We then go to the next slide.
The first finding from the implementation entity fees. What is the actual, what's the response there?
Okay, Chair, maybe I can come in. The response, recall that the implementing agents were outlining what their fees are in their financial statements. So the Auditor General was saying we should be reflecting it also in the department AFSs, and therefore currently we are working on how we then reconcile the numbers and make sure that we then reflect it after the National Treasurer. Remember that the Accountant General is supposed to open score items, because we also, in terms of the reporting format, when we prepare financial statements, we use the Treasury framework. And based on the guidance paper, the OAG also committed that they were then going to open up more score items so that we are able to reflect those in our financial statements.
Okay.
Thanks.
I will be dealing with that a little bit more in the turnaround strategy as well, Honourable Chair. The next slide, then, interest earned by the implementing entities. This was a big point of debate, and contracting with the implementing entities will now deal with the with the interest in line with the finding of the Auditor General. Basically, what it says is that the interest earned by an implementing entity must be paid back to the department. Concerns was raised about working on fire as...
What is the response? You are working on it.
We're going to write that into the contract. The contract with implementing entities, Chair, read that it should be handed back to the department, or the department can deduct it from the budget, or they can ask for written approval to apply their interest to further the deliverables of the project. The Auditor General's finding was that by doing that, and Chair, I'm not an accountant, but basically I fought this topic because I wanted us to minimize the administration. The Auditor General's finding was that you cannot use it as offsetting of income. You cannot use that by offsetting of income. Now, the administration that is going to cost us to in that interest is going to cost us a lot of money, but if that's what the Auditor General will want from us, that's what we're going to do, because we need to do our jobs.
TG?
Just to also clarify, for now we are saying yes, we'll pay that back to the revenue fund of government. In future, that's more short term, because we have got projects that are already having that interest. In future, we would then make sure that because that is also linked to the prepayments. You recall that the Auditor General was raising the fact that when we pay as a department, the implementing agent then accrues the interest.
Yeah.
So we'll then, because it's goods and services, it's no longer transfer payments, we'll then be able to avoid completely that generation of interest. It would be in exceptional cases. So for now, we will pay back until the system has matured in terms of management of goods and services, so that we don't, when you pay on invoice and you pay an amount. If it's the starting, you know, when you are doing the tenders, there's a certain amount that you pay when you start to initiate the project, and then thereafter we should not be able to, everything that you pay must be on delivery and not as prepayment. So that's what we are changing in the long-term strategy. Thanks, Chair.
The issue of the PPP came up again, and I think I've already addressed that in the findings of the feasibility study. And then the last finding, salaries paid from EPWP projects that are not in line with public works grants, and that was the non-EPWP staff members. We the we've got these people, you know, to manage a 2.1 billion rand program.
Okay.
You need
Sorry.
Staff to manage it, and that's the EPWP, the non-EPWP salaries that we're talking about.
Chair, just on the other one before we pass, the concern in terms of the audit finding was saying that in fact this contract is actually a PPP, let alone what the transaction advisor said. And you are referring us back there in terms of that argument. But what is the basis of the Auditor General saying it's in fact a PPP? Chair, I just did not want us to pass it without... Because I think there's a concern from the side of the...
Yeah, the question is understood.
Chair, the way to answer it, we are still... Our turnaround strategy, we are meeting with the Auditor General and Treasury after we finalized the plans. And they gave us the dates from the 31st to the 7th. So one of those dates, we are then going to present what we have prepared as a turnaround plan so that they can confirm that whether that satisfies them. Because it's a fact that in terms of the contract, it's written in terms of the approvals by Treasury that it is not a PPP. So they must then clear it for us with the Auditor General so that there is clarity in respect of exactly how what makes the Auditor General say is the PPP versus the PPP guidelines of Treasury, because the PPP guidelines are a document of Treasury and they are the ones that approved that this is not a PPP for us. So that will be clarified.
It's working in progress.
Yes, that's what we are putting forward is more what we think would clarify the matter, but it would have to be clarified at that level. It cannot be clarified by us.
Okay.
Chair, that's then the end of the audit discussion, my discussions of the audit. Sandiso will deal with internal audits
during
his presentation.
Yeah, you were interjected when you were explaining the salaries.
Oh, sorry, Chair. Chair, what we realized, because this came out in other implementing entities as well, is that we have to pay project managers for implementing entities that appoint project managers to manage projects. And these salaries that they were paid were higher than EPWP rates. And they for instance, found that this is not an EPWP project, but, you know, you need people to manage the project. And that was the response to that.
So this is in addition to the management fee?
Yes.
Okay.
So we have project managers, Chair, that oversee the actual implementation. And those are appointed according to normal standards.
They are in the department or they are in the...
Yes.
Okay. And the implementing entities. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So the department has got other managers because, by the way, of course, these are the control requirements that we need to have people that make sure that work happens from the department side, but also on the side of the implementing agent.
Okay. Also on the side of the implementing... No, we will get to the question
All
later.
All right, thanks.
Let's just note it, this one.
Honourable Chair, the Section D, I've just got one slide on this. What we've asked Deloitte, the oversight auditors for the environmental programs, we've asked them to give us a consolidated figure for implementing entity fees that were paid out or that were claimed from the department by implementers. And of the 1.78 billion rand that was implemented or that was deployed last year, 2017-18, by implementing entities, 100 million rand was claimed as implementer fees. That represents 5.6% of the budget. Now, Chair, to me, what is interesting and what's important here, if one assumes that your standard implementing fees, like universities claim 15% implementing fees and generally big implementation projects claim about 10% implementing fees, and our approach to the implementers is you should carry your own implementer fees as far as you can. So don't charge us for implementing fees. We're going to hold it against you. And this sign that the 5.6% that this comes up with is evidence that there are private implementers that don't claim implementer fees. That's their contribution to the project, Chair. Then we go to the process followed for procurement of goods and services. This is now for the whole of the NRM program. Now, the initial, we've got a special signed off guidelines for procurement of implementing entities by National Treasury, which is signed by the DG. And in 2014-15, we went through a big round of calling for bids. But then at the end of 2016-17, there was unclarity, it was unclear of where we were to go. And you will remember, Honourable Chair and members, that this debate between DIA and the Auditor General has been going on since the end of 2016-17. And we realized that we weren't going to be able to keep our people in the field if we go out to the market then. And the DG then approached National Treasury for a one-year extension of about 100 contracts. And that's how the 2017-18 implementing entities were procured. And they were given a 33% budget increase to go through, to get through 2017-18. But the original procurement has been done according to standards. Now, unfortunately, members, I had to show this because what's important, and you can't see it on the screen, so I'm afraid you'll have to use your printout in front of you, the process that we follow to appoint implementing entities and the levels of delegation of approval. So unless the Director General has signed off on an implementing entity appearing on the panel of implementing entities, they cannot be approved. They have to go through functionality, and we've got a whole process all the way from procurement to legal vetting and to the signing of the contract. Then the last section, Chair, the turnaround strategy for the NRM programs. Now, the whole debate between the Auditor General and DIA has led to us negotiating contracts, and at the moment we're sitting with 62 signed contracts that were signed. There was one or two that had a year to go before the last cycle, but the bulk of those 62 are contracts that started between the 1st of April and now. These contracts are signed, they're operational, they're running. What we're going to do with those contracts to get them compliant to the Auditor General's requirements, we're going to ask the implementers if they prepare to comply to the conditions of the Auditor General. If they don't comply, then we'll have to use the paragraph in the contract that says by mutual agreement we cancel the contract. But that will be followed up with an addendum to make the contract compliant. Then there's a second group of contracts that's very far at stages of negotiations. But maybe before I get there, the items on this slide, the section F, environmental continued slide, those are the items that was identified by the Auditor General on which the department must report and account for. What the Auditor General didn't touch on were UIF, COIDA, and training. I've included those three specifically, members, because there's a legal compliance issue. If the implementer doesn't pay over unemployment insurance fund or COIDA and does not train according to the prescripts of the EPWP, there is a legal implication of that, so they need to report on that. So we've got a set of reporting which they will have to do from now on that will allow the department to comply to the conditions of the Auditor General. The next slide then, as I've mentioned, there's another, it's at 118 total minus 62, it's 42 contracts that's far in negotiations, that's nearly already busy with the final sign-off, etc., etc. Those ones we will sign with the new conditions, so there wouldn't be an addendum, there wouldn't be an addendum needed for those contracts. Then there's another 100 projects that we will then immediately go, as the DG has mentioned, go into the goods and services, the quotation process. Then what we will do here is it'll be a full goods and services or a services contract with the terms of reference, and we will then call for quotations of more than one quotation per project, and the cheapest quotation will get the job. Now, they've already tendered and they've already all qualified with regards to technical qualification, functionality. So we know that they're functional and they can implement a project if they need to. All we now need to do is to get the cheapest one. And in future, all future projects will then be dealt with as a goods and services, in a goods and services approach. And that's it from me, Honourable Chair. I don't know if we want to go for questions or if we go straight into the legal framework.
Yeah, let's take the next presentation. But can somebody explain what sort of contracts are we talking about here? Just to give us a sense of the current ones and ones that have been negotiated. For supply of, maybe just give us a sense. I mean,
okay, Chair.
Talking to people who don't really know what's happening.
Okay, the colleague, when the department came to present to the committee, we outlined the different focus areas on the programs. For example, the contracts on fire management, but maybe on clearing of invasives. So you say, for this area in this province, you have 5 hectares that are infested with wattle, black wattle, or with pine trees, which must be cleared. And therefore, those are the contracts. So you are signing up a contract for somebody to provide the service of clearing.
Okay.
What we are then doing, we are paying...
So it's not part of the prepayment?
No. For now, in the past, we were combining all of that, but now we are phasing out. That's why Christo was saying the 62 is in the old stock of projects, for example. And then we have the next 100 that they are busy with. So we can change on the new projects much easier. On the ones that are existing, we need to then negotiate the new terms to include then what is required in terms of compliance.
Okay.
DG, if I'm allowed to, Honourable Chair, just to add one thing. These contracts were very much aimed at job creation. So one of our deliverables of our implementing entities, that's the difference between our contracts and the usual government supply chain management contracts. We want to maximize employment, so employment becomes a deliverable in those contracts. It's a very strong deliverable of the contract. And remember, we have to report to EPWP on wages paid and so forth. So we have to always have to allow for that in our contracts.
Okay. Dr. Preston.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning to you and good Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, DG and colleagues. I'm going to take us through the legal framework under which we're working at the moment and where we are looking to strengthen that at the end. So as you're fully aware, the department gets its its mandate from the Constitution, from NEMA, and from specific Environmental Management Acts. Powers assigned in terms of Section 97 of the Constitution, such as indigenous forests that have been assigned to the department. Section 24 of the Constitution of the Republic guarantees everyone to a right to an environment that's not harmful to their health or well-being. And then the bold bit, and to have an environment protected for the benefit of present and future generations through reasonable legislative and other measures that prevent, in our case, ecological degradation and promote conservation, along with secure ecologically sustained development and use of natural resources. The National Environmental Management Act, NEMA, of 1998, environment means the surroundings within which humans exist and are made up of land, water, and atmosphere of the earth, microorganisms, plants, and animal life, and any part or combination of one or two that interrelationships among them and between them, and the physical, chemical, aesthetic, and cultural properties and conditions of the foregoing that influence human health and well-being, fire being an obvious component of that. The legal framework further with NEMA Section 2, the objectives of the Act, is within the framework of NEMA to provide management and conservation of biological diversity within the Republic and of components such as biological diversity and the need to protect ecosystems as a whole, including species which are not targeted for exploitation. It's also in Section C, 2C, to provide for cooperative governance in the biological management and conservation, an important consideration given that there are many departments that have an influence on natural resource management. The state's trusteeship of biological diversity in Section 3 of NEMBA, National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act. In fulfilling the rights contained in Section 24 of the Constitution, the state, through its organs that implement legislation applicable to biodiversity, must manage, conserve, and sustain South Africa's biodiversity and its components in general.
Can you go straight to the narrative there, Dr. Preston? It talks about several of South Africa's biomass. Let's leave the other stuff.
Which one? Sorry, Chair, I didn't hear. Do you want me to go to to that one?
Yeah, here. Let's start from here.
Sure.
I think that part we know.
Okay, thank you. So several of South Africa's biomes are fire-adapted. Our frameless, obviously, grasslands and other systems that use fire as part of the ecological functioning of the biome. And most of their plants have adapted to fire, including many of them that use fire as part of germination and production. The timing or cycles of fires have also evolved over long periods of time, and a failure to maintain these can lead to senescent, unproductive felts, to a buildup of biomass that can lead to intense fires, which in turn can lead to threats to biodiversity, so loss of species even. Water repellency in soil, erosion, flooding, siltation, and destruction, to a spread of invasive species and to a loss of especially plant species and their symbiotic species. So there are many other species that are associated with them that would also die out if they are to be threatened. Development is the key disruptor of natural fire cycles, so forestry farming, game ranching, national parks, urban development, water management systems, and many others, they all have impacted upon the extent to which there are optimal fire cycles. Because we want to protect so many of these things, we're managing fire in ways that do lead to the kind of problems mentioned in the previous things, the senescent felts and so on. So wildfires have to be carefully managed, both those that occur and those that do not but should occur. And this is being exacerbated by climate change. So climate change is making the whole management of fire so much more difficult and requiring a lot of research to really understand how best we do then have our controlled burns. These are all key considerations in natural resource management as captured in the mandate of the Department of Environmental Affairs. So in doing all of these things, we are certainly within our mandate to look at how we use fire, both in terms of unintended negative consequences, but also the very important positive consequences of well-managed fires or naturally occurring fires. The Working on Fire program, and this also applies to Working for Water and Working for Wetlands and other programs, has since its establishment been a partnership between DEAR, DAF and DWS. Those are government's principal natural resource management departments and the National Disaster Management Center in COCTA. The provincial departments of environmental affairs have also been partners alongside the later emergence of the fire protection associations. Prior to the establishment of Working on Fire, there was no integrated fire management capacity for wildfires, that is, across the country, and the capacity to manage wildfires for optimal outcomes was severely compromised. The establishment of a national Working on Fire program has been the single most significant activity that has led to the vast improvement in integrated fire management, wildfire management in the country. As agreed with our partners in the National Treasury, our partners being DEAR, DAF, DWS and COCTA, it would not make sense to have fire management capacities in each of these departments. This would be duplicative, expensive and inevitably inefficient. That is particularly because wildfires are seasonal, so in the summer season you have fires down here in the southwestern Cape, you have fires all year round in the southern Cape areas into the eastern Cape, and then the rest of the country with fire-prone systems are winter fire seasons. We also are having, perhaps linked to climate change, an expansion of the range of fires, so the Northern Cape has not been an area where fire has been a problem historically, but particularly with some invasive grasses moving into the area, it's anticipated that it will become a more significant factor that we have to address. Part of the success of the National Working on Fire program is its capacity and ability to move firefighters, firefighting capacity, so those are firefighters, the fleets, the aerial support and management around the countries as conditions require. So you saw that in Knysna, for example, in the fires there, where we had such a significant impact on the level of damage by bringing in people from all parts of the country. The representatives of COCTA, DAF and DWS sit on the oversight committee of the program, together with ourselves, of course. They assist in the planning and prioritization of Working on Fire interventions. They have contributed financially to the program in the past, and this has been revived. And noting that the funding that we get, being EPWP, is indeed a government-wide program. It is recognized by these departments that they will not establish their own capacities to manage wildfires, but rather work through Working on Fire. In terms of the metros, district and local authorities, there's a well-established framework through which WAF assists in wildfire management, so the disaster fires. The training that our firefighters have, as well as their equipment, is particularly aimed at wildfires. They are not trained to do structural firefighting. But it's also quite obvious when there are fires, if you were to watch a fire when they break out now around the Table Mountain here in the next several months, you would see that the teams that go up the mountain to fight the fires are indeed the Working on Fire capacity. They're not the structural firefighters whose equipment and training is much more aimed at structural firefighting. Like I said, our firefighters are not trained for structural firefighting, and at most we might help with mopping up if we requested to do so by the fire chief. The National Treasury has already proclaimed on the efficacy of a national note wild firefighting capacity of Working on Fire, and saying that this does not impact on the grants that are made to the structural firefighting capacity. I think it has been raised by the chair and other members of the committee and indeed our own legal people that we need to strengthen and be more explicit around this mandate. That doesn't change the fact that there will still have to be cooperative government governance around this. So one option is currently considered is to table the Natural Resource Management Agency Bill. And we are currently working with the with COPTA to look at the business case to determine the feasibility of some sort of entity. Thank you, Chair. That's the presentation.
Okay, thank you. Next one.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm just going to give a quick overview of the business model, governance, and performance of the Working on Fire program in the year 2017-18. Our objectives are very clear in terms of a program. We've got three key pillars to it. One is obviously job creation, and over the last 15 years, some 15,000 people have passed through the Working on Fire program. The program is approximately 5,000 people strong in this year, the 17-18 year. The second tier is the skills development, and we have a training academy that contributes to this component, and of course very importantly is contributing to South Africa's integrated fire management capacity. The recent firestorm we had in Knysna last year in June is indicative of a huge lacuna in terms of our emergency response, which Working on Fire was able to respond to quite importantly. We practice integrated fire management, and this is a large document here. I won't detail it, but it covers the entire spectrum of preventative, educational work in our communities, the actual fire suppression, the dispatch and coordination, the post-fire rehabilitation, as well as research and development has been touched for. Just in terms of scale, if you look at the map, Chair, you'll see our bases are across the country, barring sort of large patches in the middle of north, in the Northern Cape, in the fire-prone regions. But more importantly, besides this spread, is we overlay it with the poverty index in the country. You'll see that we are also present in probably the areas most in need of such poverty relief programs. In terms of our Working on Fire model, and this is something which you know, the presence of Working Fire doesn't quite reveal. We have a holding company which provides the overall strategy, integration and coordination of a number of services around the program itself. We have the Department of Environment Affairs through which the expanded public works funds are channeled, and it's set to enter into an entity called Working on Fire Pty Limited. Initially it was FFA Operations. We changed the name to simplify some of our contractual arrangements when we wanted to lease property for offices. We had the legal entity was at that time FFA Pty Limited, and the program was WAF, and people obviously had difficulty reconciling that. So within that entity, you have the senior management, the functional service, the operational services in that entity, but that in itself does not constitute the Working on Fire program. You have an entity that's part of the Kishu Group called Training, where we do all our training. And I will end this with an invitation to the Portfolio Committee, as we've done last time, to visit our academy, preferably around a graduation ceremony. We also have Kishugu Aviation, which uses its own resources as well as independent aerial resources. And we also control the fuel supply at one depot. And all these aircraft which come from our asset entity gets into our aerial component of our fighting. I think it's important to stress that you can't fight fires only from the air, and you can't necessarily fight always from the ground. If it's a huge fire, you need the aerial resources, as we saw in Knysna, and that in itself does not combat the fire in itself. You do need the ground forces. We also have the fleet component of our assets company, which provides the huge fleet of vehicles. But even with all of this put together, we still don't have a program. We need partners on the ground. We don't own the land. We're not the landowners. And we've got a range of partners, be it sand parks, the provincial parks, the fire protection associations, the private landowners, local government, municipalities. All of these come together with us. So this is really a partnership that we pull together. And it's not commonly understood. Obviously, everyone sees the firefighters when they're at the fire. But in fact, for that to work, a considerable amount of entities come together to create the Working on Fire program. And that Working on Fire program then produces the data that we religiously report every month to the department on employment data, skill development, and wildfire management data, which we then feed back into the department. So if you look at this diagram, you're looking at quite a complex set of entities which come together to bring it. It's not a simple program where you just have firefighters and they do their things. You have inputs coming from the Kishuga group of countries, but more importantly, you have a range of partners, and not each partner is the same. Even managing that partners is a huge and complex task, because even when they have the same name, they don't behave the same. So it's a program which is a model which has grown over the last 15 years, and I think we cannot claim we've perfected it, but I think we've done it probably in the most economical fashion to actually deal with wildland firefighting in the world. And I think we have a lot of attention being paid to how we do it. In terms of governance, we have a board. This is the board in 2017-18. You'll see both, you have your directors and your non-executive directors, as well as executive directors in the form of myself and Ms. Nsomi. And that board is something we report to on a quarterly basis, as is common in terms of the Companies Act. That board also has a finance and HR and ethics and OHS committee, occupational health and safety. But we also have a monthly meeting with the Kishuga group of companies to ensure that we have the proper coordination of all the entities, as well as adherence to our contracts. Every month we report to the DEA on our KPI report. Every quarter we then use those reports as a basis for drawdown of funds, which is against the performance indicators. Every quarter we have an NRM oversight committee, and this is essentially a committee of stakeholders where we get a review from our stakeholders and report to them on performance, and that then feeds into the NRM WAF Exco, where we have DEA and other government departments which are empowered to make decisions about the operation of this company. So it's quite a complex set of governance, reporting lines and accounting. In terms of the actual operations, we have an executive committee, and I won't go in detail, but we have all the key functions there, from HR, the finance, the IT, occupational health and safety, communications, operations, and our provincial departments. That's our team that actually manages the organization on a day-to-day basis. And in our provinces, in each of the 8 provinces, because in the case of the Northern Cape, the basis at the northern end of the Northern Cape is managed by the Northwest, we have a team of management, because if you look at that map that we presented earlier, you'll see that we're quite widely spread through the country. And those provinces have their own structures, where they've got 4 basic clusters. A very important cluster, which is the heart of our operations, is the operations cluster. We have a communications cluster, which does very important fire awareness work, as well as communication requirements in the province and community liaison, and then our employee cluster with HR, payroll, social development, occupational health and safety, and obviously our finance and controlling of our assets in terms of our stock control. I think what's very interesting to note, if you note all the yellow-colored boxes, these are boxes we actually designate for previous Working on Fire firefighters. And right now we've got about 160 of our 320 management, which are former firefighters who've just come up in the management core of the program. In terms of our key performance indicators, this is something we report on, and a little bit more, every month. And of course the key indicators are things like person days and the derivative full-time equivalents. If you look at the actual versus the target for 2017-18, you'll see that the green box, 107% indicator, we exceeded. If you look at the participants we employed, the youth we employed, the females as that, the people with disabilities is well beyond what we are targeted for. The others are just below 100% in the 90s, 98, 95, 91%. Our training is a very important part of our component. In this year, we reached 98% of our training target, with as much as 84% of that being our target for accredited training. Similarly, with our health and safety, in terms of this disabling injury frequency rate, we're doing better than our target of 3. Our social development, we're quite extensive in terms of workshops we have with our firefighters, as well as our community awareness fire programs. Further indicators that we also report on include prescribed burning, the kind of preventative work that we do, and again there, hugely in excess of targets, 179%, 104%, and then obviously the manual fuel reduction was lower because we were engaged in other activities around fuel reduction. Our B rating, we are level 1B supplier, so above the target that we have in our contract. Fleet, we are a bit below our target in terms of the number of seats we have available. In helicopter days, just marginally below target, 98%. Spotter days, 121%. And even though the contract doesn't call for bombers, we also report on the number of bomber days we have available there. Our dispatchers are about 90% of the dispatchers available. And our fires attended, even though those are not targets in the sense of what we must reach, we do keep a record of what we achieve. And an average, in fact, if you can call the target, of 2.5. So in that year, we attended 2,231 fires, and the teams were dispatched on 955 occasions for fires. Just in terms of demographics, the management representation, you'll see that we have, across our levels of employment, executive only 8, senior employees are 20, our middle management is 70, our junior managers are 120, so you'll see that we've got quite a good demographic representation across our strata of management. In our firefighters itself, 93% are African, 7% colored, and we have 3% disabled. And the age groups, we're overwhelmingly in the youth group in terms of what we do, with only 9% being age and 35 and above. Okay. One of the important things we do that is not necessarily always as visible is our fire awareness and communication. And if you look at our figures for this year, we attended such operations at 1,392 schools, where we reached 100,000 learners, 746 learners. We also do work with educators, so we reached 7,051 educators. We had 1,787 community meetings in which we reached 105,748 people. And we also train our firefighters to do these activities through workshops in which we had 957. I think it's quite interesting to reflect that over the last 7 years, we have actually reached 2.1 million people through this educational work that we've done. Our communication, which is part of our contractual obligations, is we publish, and I think you'll see in your little pack that we provided you, both the publications on the Working on Fire monthly publication, as well as a report on how many people we've managed to place in formal employment outside of the program, because ultimately the success of the program is how many people are able to move on to jobs. So we've got newsletters, which we've provided to you. We've done a calculation of the value of the media, and it's about 72 million during that year. We got 1,730 online distributions of our publications. We have 41 videos that we produced during the year. Our Facebook, Twitter, and website figures are also showing quite a bit of uptake. During that year, we had some 2,000 hours of flying, covering our choppers, our spotters, and our bombers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. The next one,
which I hope will be the last.
Morning, Chair, and morning to honourable members of Parliament as well. I will be taking you through the finance of Working on Fire. The presentation is split into three sections: expenditure overview of the last financial years, the annual financial statement for 2017-2018, and then BEE after that. I think the first slide just shows on the last, over the last 4 years, how do we spend? I think most of our budget is spent, I think over 50% of our budget is spent on wages, salaries, and other benefits. And other benefits being your funeral policy. So if a firefighter passes away, it covers the spouse and also their children and pays out 20,000 rand. And then you also have pre- and post-medicals for firefighters. And then also we've got a compensation fund as well, which is run by FEM, so for injury on duty or any disabling injuries. So when those unfortunate situations happens, we actually pay out on for disability amount as well, for disability income. And then after that, we have your PPC, and the trend you can see we have it's called, if we go to the budget later on about the funds, we will see that the correlation of how we spend the money and also the spend pattern and also the budget pattern. And then the PPC is basically for the it's your protective clothing and protective equipment. There's not much difference in the previous years. I think when we started the first year, we bought more, and then as we go, we are actually buying less and less every year. And then the training, basically, this is based on how many people we have got and how many people exit the program, and then we will train people based on that. And the transport, basically, that's transporting firefighters to the fires. And that in the first year was the implementation year, so the spending was quite less. And then after that, we had implemented, rolled out all the vehicles into all provinces, so then it became stable after that, all the other years. And then operational costs, these are rental, communication costs, telephone costs, your travel costs, so this where it is, and your IT cost as well. And those have been, when we started, I think we paid more, and then we're currently trying to reduce that. That's what we look for when we need to actually to reduce the cost, those operational costs. And then the FPAs, these are just the contribution that we pay to the land, the FPAs. In terms of the contract, I think 1.4% of the budget should be given to support the FPAs. So it's just a contribution that we make into their operations. And then aviation, these are just standing fees we contribute. So partners ordinarily would contribute 60%, we contribute 40% of the standing fees for the aircraft as well. And then the management fee is based on the 9.6%, and there's a slide where, in each slide, you actually will go through the breakdown of this. And then the next slide is basically the 2017-2018 financial year, where 58% of the budget was spent on wages, salaries, and other benefits, and then 3% was on PPC and PPE, and then 46% on training, and transport was 8%, and then operational variable cost was 7%, and your FPA 1%, and then aviation was 6%, and then management fee was 9.6%. I think that the rounding, it makes it a 10. And this is include both the Working on Fire program and the high altitude program. And then the 2017 figures, it basically follows the same trend. There we spent 55% of the budget on wages and salaries and other benefits. 5% was on PPC and PPE. Training was 7%. transport 9%, and then OVC was 6%, and FPA is 1%, aviation 9%, and then management fee was 9.6%. And then in 2016, we had wages of wages salaries, it was 54%, and then we had PPC and PPE at 6%, training at 7%, transport 9%, OVC at 49%, and then FPA at 1%, and then aviation 6%, and then management fee was 9%. I think in this year, there were funds that were extra, were adjusted during the year, and in that 40 million, there was no management fee charged by the implementing agent. So hence the implementation fee went down. Also, on the 2015, that was the first year of the implementation of the contract, 51% of the cost went to wages, salaries, and other benefits. And then we had 6% on PPC and PPE, training 10%, because that year we actually trained more people, because it was our first year. And then 8% was transport, OVC was 7%, and 1% is FPAs, aviation was 7%, and management fee was 9.6%. Then now I'm going to move into the financial statements. The copies of the actually audited financial statements are in the pack. Our auditors were PricewaterhouseCoopers. Working on Fire Working on Fire Pty Ltd is part of the group of Kishubu Group, previously known as FFA Group. It is a ring-fenced private company, SPV, which is for implementation of the Working on Fire program and related projects. And it has its own governance structure, as Trevor has already gone through it. Any funds, any surplus funds earned by the Working on Fire from the third parties are invested back to the project to supplement the budget if the budget is not enough, and also to build extra capacity so we create more employment. So, and there we've got an extract of the from the financial statements of the retained income of what we use. And also something I would like to highlight is that we also had an unqualified audit opinion since the inception of Working on Fire. And all the figures that are in the financial statement, they exclude VAT. Compared to the other figures that we have just gone through, they include VAT, those. Okay. I'm just going to take through the committee on some highlights of the financial statements. I'm not going through the entire financial statement. So we've got the balance sheet there. In the property, plant, and equipment, we have 15 million there, and ordinarily our assets will be your office equipment, your computers, your desks, also your brush cutters, your chainsaws, and all the other tools that will last more than a year. So we have been recorded as an asset. And also on the current assets, we've got inventory, which is more the PPC, so the protective clothing or any other items that are consumable that will last us a year. And then on the trade and other receivables, those are the debtors we have, because when we go out to stop a fire, actually the partner is responsible for paying the variable cost, which is the kilometers and also any meals that was needed in that fire. So we actually invoice partners on that, and then that's what it is in there. And then cash and cash equivalents, that's just the cash that was at the bank at the end of the year. And then the other is the trade and other liabilities of 100 million. So at the next page, I've took an extract of that out of note number 9, just to show the how is the 10 million, 100 million made up
Can I just find out the 15 million? Is it 15 million?
Yes.
is the value of the assets?
Yes, the book value of the assets.
Okay, but I saw on the chart there's some expenditure on transport.
Yes.
Is it not on vehicles and stuff?
Yes. So the vehicles are on a FML, full maintenance lease contract.
Yeah,
and
for 2018 it was 256 million. So what happens to this? Is it not part of the... Does it not go to the asset? Is this not vehicles that are owned by the program?
At this point, currently, yes, ultimately they will be owned by the program. It's a full maintenance lease contract. And in terms of accounting, it's an operating lease. So at the end of the 5 years, and which is some of them, they are coming out at the end of their 5 years in the next year or two. So they will be recognized into working on fire's books as that happens. We've got a list of all those vehicles, and they are properly branded working on fire in yellow as well. So they will only, ownership will pass at the end of the at the end of the lease period.
Okay. So 56 million is spent on rental of this cars.
It's not a rental. It's basically it's a lease with a the ownership in mind.
Okay.
It's about 200. It's 200 and something vehicles. It's not only the 200. All of them is 230. All of them.
Okay. So they will be reflected in the financials as assets once you acquire ownership.
Yes.
So aviation, 43 million. So there's nothing in aviation that is part of the assets of the program.
No, in terms of aviation, we buy a service, not the asset.
Service provided by who?
By Kishugo Aviation.
Okay, let's proceed.
And then on note 9, I think of the 100 million is the trade payables, 24 million. And then accrued liabilities, those are just accounting journals we made for leave provision and other provisions. And then value-added tax, the VAT we needed to pay, that's 4.4. And then the income received in advance. So that is basically... will match into the assets that we have on the books. So whatever funds we receive, when we buy assets, in terms of accounting, we need to put them into a liability, and then as we depreciate it, we will recognize it into the income statement as well. And then the next slide, and then it's the revenue, it's the income statement. Work on Fire made a small profit of 432 last year. And I think the entire revenue is about 708, and then we've got all the cost of sales in that. And then the next slide actually shows the breakdown of the cost, the detailed income statement as well there, with mainly your aviation fees and your management fee, and also salaries and wages, their biggest cost, and training as well, being the biggest cost of all that we have. And then the next one shows us a few other expenditures we have. And then the next slide is just shows the revenue. What revenue? This is from in 2015, the DR revenue, DR revenue, and also it shows on 2016 the DR revenue was at 621, and then 2017 618. And on 2018, 674
okay.
million.
So there's a slide that you jumped there.
Which one?
The selected explanatory notes.
Yes.
Yeah, can you just go through that?
Which one? The first one. Okay. The advertising one. There's advertising costs, and then there's also audit fees, which is basically that's for our auditors, both internal and external auditors. And then there's some bad debts. I think those were some...
No. Not that one.
Oh, this one. Okay. This one, okay.
The next. Yeah. The next one, yeah.
Okay. Just to go through this, I think we've got the opening stock. That's inventory, that's a PPC and PPE. So that one you need to read that with closing stock and your stock adjustment, so that will add up to what we have in terms of the entire stock of PPC, because that is an income effect of the inventory that's sitting on the balance sheet. So you have an opening stock, and then you buy whatever you need to buy during the year, the purchases, and then you have a closing stock.
You know, if you can speak next to the mic.
Okay, sorry. Yes, I'm saying that in terms of the opening stock, that relates to the inventory, which is the PPC and PPE. So from the balance sheet that you have last year, that will become your opening stock. Whatever you buy this year will be your purchases, and then you minus, you less your closing stock based on whatever the count at the end of the year was, because you'll be issuing stock during the year as well. So that those need to be right with that. And then the next one will be accommodation. So basically there's an accommodation cost for the entire program in all 8 provinces. So when people go into the bases, those are the costs that are related to that. And then after that, there's aviation. So that's basically the aviation costs. These are the entire cost that includes gear contribution and also the external parties contribution, because we invoice the entire amount to third parties, and then we receive all the revenue, and also we actually get invoiced for the full cost. But DIA does not contribute.
There's something confusing me.
Yes.
On 2018, that summary that you have there.
On the 2018?
You spent 2018 financial year.
Yes.
You spent 43,267,000, and then 17-18 year you've got aviation fees for 62 million.
Yes.
So it confuses me. What is the difference there?
The difference is that the first one is based on those few slides, it's about based on the DIA's budget. So DIA's funds, how much was spent, how those funds were spent. And then this is the entire how much we spent on aviation in total. So part of this is funded by DIA, and part is funded by third parties. Like I explained when I spoke about the aviation fees, that 40% is spent by DIA, which is the amount that's on the first slide, and then 60% come from third parties.
Okay.
Can I just make a quick comment to that? The component funded by DIA is the standing fees with all the helicopter or with all aviation resources. You fund standing fees and then you fund the flying hours, and the partners pay for the flying hours. And the second figure that Sandiso has referred to in their income statement was the total income for. But working, DIA doesn't fund the whole flying sources.
I think, yes. DIA doesn't fund any flying costs. Those are funded by the partners. And also in the standing fees, they don't fund the full 100% of the cost. So the partners also contribute to that. It's just a contribution we give as well. And then there is aviation fees, 72, and then communication and information, those are telephones, 7.6 million, those are telephones and your IT infrastructure cost, and then you've got the depreciation from the assets, and then you've got directors and muniments, which is more of the executives' cost and the entire executive cost, salaries and wages, electricity, electricity and water, 1 million, 1.9 million equipment, and then fuel is 197, management fee 64,709, and then other operational cost is 4.9, and PPC is 21 million, postage and courier 1.7, printing and stationery 1.8.
Okay, no, it's fine. Just talk to the big ones.
Okay, and then the next big one will be your salaries and wages, which is 331, that's paid, basically that we already explained that one, that side. The staff welfare, 4 million, and then you've got training at 42 million, and then transport and travel at 131 million. And then that also, the transport as well, we have, that includes any cost that the partner is actually paying as well. It's not only the DR funding. And then I think, and then the closing stock. Then to the, go to the next slide, there we've got basically, I think the only big one was a foreign exchange.
Can move on to the other ones.
Come again? Move on. Okay. And then the next slide is the revenue. So 2015, the budget was 567 from DIA, and then the 621 million on 2016, and then we had 6187 from 618 from 2017, and then 674 in 2018. And then we also got third party resources, which basically what we usually balance the budget with. And in 2015 it was 56 million, and then in 2016 it was 49 million, and then in 2017 it was 185 million, and then in 2018 was 148 million. So that's basically, it helps us to actually balance the budget. I think our budget has not significantly grown in the last 4 years. And then the last slide basically is the BE and procurement. Working on Fire is a level 1 BE and contributes 135%. And the actual cost spent on the SME is 17 million, with 25, number of suppliers 25, and also 29% of the spend, of the entire procurement spend, was spent on the BE partners.
Are you done with the procurement part?
Yes.
Okay. So the total procurement is what, 60.9 million. I thought you were also going to tell us where do you spend this one.
Where?
Where?
In terms of the province or?
No. Okay, let's leave that for the questions.
Okay.
Okay, this is the last presentation, I suppose. Eh? Okay. Thank you very much. It was a long one. I hope members have been able to make notes and so they can answer questions. They can ask questions. So. Okay, I think now we've got the relevant information from the department and the working for fire, working on fire. Members, do you have questions? Can I get hands? Dr. Liang? And then followed by Honorable Khadebe, and we'll just come this way.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let me first appreciate the presentations for the fact that they have been simplified for the understanding of all of us. Also safe to indicate that the working on fire as a form of job creation and skill development, it requires sustainability. I would want to check, Chair, from the DG, if is there any mechanism that they contemplate to employ in order for this particular program to be in the majority of cases benefit the rural communities. Because if job creation is just generally applied, there is no specific focus to the previously disadvantaged, and also skills development. I think the NDP imperatives will also be addressed if the department would prioritize that notion. Then secondly, Chair, this initiative is much more social in nature. So it requires partnerships, or partnerships with the department, working with the different civil society organizations with a similar mission and vision. So if that is in place, can we get specifics around that and locate those civil society bodies in order for us, even at our constituency level, we are able to interact with them? On AG, is it practical in the department to ensure that you don't necessarily wait for AG to come during their periods as specified in the policy as to when should they come and make a determination? Just engage AG in between, in order that you familiarize yourself with the specific requirements, and also to empower more the officials, especially the entities, understand exactly what actually does it take to be the one that are accounting, not necessarily to keep papers, and also you are commensurate with the mandate of the department and the impact of such service deliverables. Yeah, thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Honourable Khadev.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm really a bit concerned, Chair, as you just pointed out, on the audited annual financial statements, it gives different figures on your notes. And then when you go to the presentation that you have given us, the WOF and HAT combined expenditure for 2018, aviation is 43. Then if you go to the other one, I hear that your explanation, but what do you mean by this combined? It's working on fire and HAT combined expenditure for 2018 is 64, it's 43. Then when you go a little bit down on your explanatory notes, it's it's 62. Exclude other partners which we haven't mentioned on the working on fire and HAT. Does that include another third party? Not only those two. I would like to get more clarity on that. And to the DG Chairperson, I was of the impression that any surplus that is left, it goes back to Treasury. And I don't know, maybe it's a contractual arrangement that you have with Working on Fire that they keep any surplus to fund their future activities. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. I thought you were still speaking. Honorable Stenkamp.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got two questions. One is fairly vague, but what do you do with your firefighters when they're at the base, or when they, you know, when they don't have to go fight fires, etc.? How do you keep them busy apart from training, etc.? That's more curiosity. But and then my other question is on section, it says section B, working on fire program audit findings. It says that the concern was raised around a possible duplication of operational costs in relation to directors and employees. And then the response says, after detailed analysis, it was concluded that there was no duplication. I would like to, I'd just like you to elaborate what concerns on or what was duplicated. What did they say you're duplicating? The response is just a bit vague. I just want clarity. Thank you. Thank you, Jay.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Nyambi.
Thanks, Chairperson. On provincial general manager, that page, because there are no numbers here, there is a number of vacant posts there. When are they going to be filled? Thanks, Chairperson, is that one.
Thank you.
Chairperson, thanks. Firstly, perhaps, first let me appreciate the presentations. My question, perhaps to you, DG, firstly, is the fact that this is not a triple P kind of a model. What is the actual implication? What does it mean, Chair, on management fees, it's not numbered these slides, and I've not counted them for ease of reference. But there's one that says, in terms of the actions taken by the department, and it's being continued in one of the pages. Point 4 says, or reads, the unlocking of third-party resources was made one of the schedules of the memorandum of agreement with an incentive to the implementing entity to earn more management fees. I think to some degree it was being explained, but it's like by its very nature, the contract was such that the management fees will serve as an incentive, will be higher. So it will not comply to any of the general norms, because that needed to be unlocked so that as and when the third-party resources are raised, then management fees should be higher. That is the understanding. So it's not clear to can say, and I'm driving this point here because the AG says management fees must beforehand be separated from the other fees, operation fees and so on. And the department had difficulty to try and separate that. And our view was that in terms of the modified cash standards, that needed to happen as it's being requested. Now, to me, it says that perhaps at times it's not even easy for the department to know beforehand what could be the management fees if the mobilization of such funds may happen in the course of the implementation of the program. That if for this financial year you have agreed to a particular funding, as here, but the entity has got a discretion or a right to mobilize more funds from third parties. That management fee ultimately will depend on how much was raised. So DIA may only know its own beforehand in that financial year. Perhaps that can further be clarified in terms of what we have to. And what I'm trying to say, Chair, is that perhaps from where we're sitting in terms of causing the entity to account, it can only be known how much they must account for in terms of the monies raised for that particular financial year under review. My second question, Dr. Preston, is the response time for working on fire. Both in the Western Cape and in all the other provinces. Is it as effective? Perhaps it may be more effective in the Western Cape than in other provinces inland. But what's your experience? Are we as effective as we're supposed to? My third point, how much is the rate of flying the helicopter per an hour? The last one, Chair, or last but one. How does, or how do you account for the monies for the third parties? That's right, for DAF, DWS and so on. Do you as well go and appear before them and say this is how we spent your money, or you account to DIA, to the, this portfolio committee? Do you run around these bodies and go around accounting, or how do you handle that? Let me as well add my voice to the question earlier on raised by Dr. Luyang on SMEs, and I would like to think that refers as well to triple BEEs, procurement and so on. Does the program witness any movement in terms of transformation in that regard, so that we don't necessarily continue to do things the old way and procure many of these things from particular companies? They may be small, but not necessarily triple BEE. To me, I don't want to think that SME enterprises necessarily refers to the triple BEE. Are you able to unpack that? Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I just also want to ask, and then we'll break, and then you can sort yourself out to answer our questions. I would like to get an explanation from on the international deployments. I think there was a slide that mentioned about three deployments and some percentages that was reflected there. Can we please explain this arrangement for international deployments? What are the actual arrangements? Do you get, does Working on Fire or the company get additional to what it is receiving as a management fee? So explain those arrangements there. There is an issue about procurement of protective clothing, which is one of the issues also that the AG has raised.
Can you please tell us where do you procure this protective clothing, and what process do you follow? Because I see it's quite a significant amount. In 2018, it was 21 million. 2017, it was 30 million. It's PPC, eh? Combined with PPE. What's PPE? Or equipment, so it's combined. Okay. Well, yeah, the figures are there and they are quite significant. So tell us where do you procure this, because this was an issue as well. Now, there's an issue about duplication of operational costs, just to add on what Honorable Steenkamp was raising. Now, there's a structure there in the presentation, which has got executive committee, which has got Mr. Trevor Abrahams as managing directors and the rest of the other executives there. So I suppose these are the management people who are receiving salaries in the working WOF. Now, does any of those employees part of management? Not part of the directors of is it Kishiku? Kishiku. If you can just explain that, because there's also an issue about salaries there. So we need to understand whether those who are paid salaries, is it only management, it's not directors. And my other question, which is also coming as a bit of a concern to me, there's a management fee of about 10% that is paid to the management company, Kishigu. And when you're making a presentation, you're saying there's also procurement that of services from the same company that gets paid the management fees. What are the arrangements, especially the aviation fees there? And I don't know what other services, maybe you can also explain if there's more other services that gets procured from the same company. So those would be my question. On the legal provision, I think, but maybe I'll make my comments, closing comments at the end, because I think we need to have clarity around this matter of the legal mandate and also the implementation model. There is a proposal for the agency which we once were supposed to process, but it didn't go through cabinet. So would want to understand what is the thinking currently, when is that process going to be finalized, because the sooner we get that, the better. Because there's a lot of frustrations, there's a lot of compliance issues currently, and I think that the sooner we get that agency, the better this program can be best implemented. But of course, there's some outstanding issues around the legal provision, which I don't want us to get deeper into them now. Maybe at one stage we'll be able to do that, because the act that you are relying on to implement this Working on Fire
is the act that belongs to agriculture, forest, and you know that act, DG. Yes. Yeah. I'm saying I don't want us to get deeper into that, but I still have some issues around that. But I guess it's something that we can discuss at some future date. But for now, let's stick to these questions about this other model, this other implementation agency. So we are going to break for about 5 minutes. We'll be back at 10 to 12. We'll allow you to sort yourself out and respond to the question. Oh, my last question is on the SMME expenditure. See, it's only about 29% or something like that, less than 30%. Are you happy with that? It doesn't augur well for me. 30% of over a billion expenditure. Okay, so you'll sort yourself out and then we'll come back at 10 to. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, are you ready to respond? Okay.
Thanks, Chair. I will start off with some of the question honourable members raised. I think the question on the partnerships, location, who, where, I think it's a very useful thing. We can give the committee a detailed report. We have got every base by which municipality falls under, which ward its location, the physical address. So I think that kind of report should be able to give you a full picture. I should indicate that our partners range from municipalities to conservation agencies to landowners associated in the FPA, Fire Protection Association. So there's quite a range of partners that we deal with. But I think that report will give a full detailed list of every base, which ward is in, which municipality it is in, and the physical address of where the base is. So I think we can do that quite easily. On the aviation budget, just to clarify the point, the allocation from DEA covers a part of the aviation expenses. But in order for the full service to be rendered, in most cases people who use the service pay for the hour, and there was a question in terms of cost of helicopter. That's about 30,000 rand an hour at the moment to fly it, and that delivers a ton of water every bucket drop. The aerial bomber, which is slightly faster, and that delivers about 3 tons for every drop, 3,000 liters or 1,000 liters per drop. So that's the cost. We did do a calculation one time in terms of what it costed. I would need to update it, but I think we came up to a calculation of about 6 rand a litre to deliver a litre. Now, when you consider where it's being delivered, in the remoteness of it, in up in mountains and everything, you can't comparably deliver water at that. It's expensive. You know, it's a flying machine. So DEA money contributes a certain amount, so that's where the 40-odd million that's recorded in our DEA allocation. But where people pay in for the service, you'll see the full cost comes closer to the 60-odd million that has been recorded in the other area. The question has been raised repeatedly around third-party revenue surplus, and maybe let's address it holistically there. The contract allowed for us to expand the service of working on fire by virtue of third-party revenues earned, whether we do burning, whether we charge for the use of the vehicles, etc. The concept at that time was to try and expand the scope of the program. I think over the last 2 years, the budgetary increment from DEA has been in the region of 3%, whereas simply the wage component and salary component went up by 6%. So we've actually been looking at a decline in real terms of the budget. So a lot of the third-party revenue that we've been earning has allowed us to keep the program at its current strength without having any layoffs or retrenchments. So it's actually making up the deficit in real terms of what we've been earning. Because when your budget goes up by 3%, but your wage bill, which is about 58%, goes up by 6%, you're obviously looking at less money to be applied for the program in general. I think a very interesting question, what do the firefighters do when they're not at the fires? You're absolutely right. The fires are, fighting fires is a small percentage of the time. I think what the other activities they do is particularly the fire awareness activities, where they go into communities, where they go into schools. And this is a very important development aspect of our firefighters. We train them to be able to educate us. And they're very proud of being able to go into schools and be respected as educators now in their communities in that. So they do the fire thing. Out of fire season, they also do other preventive activities like the fire breaks, the fuel load reduction. So the integrated fire manager requires all of that. And, of course, they have to be recertified, so they go to a training camp every year to be certified for a yellow card that allows them to go back to the fire. So there's a range of activities. And then around the base where they are, they also do various base maintenance, particularly in the conservation agencies, etc. So that's some of the range of activities they do. They also have gardens that they grow, and very often they adopt a local orphanage or an old age home, and they're going to supply the goods to the home. So it's a big personal transformation that happens for young people who were never respected, never had a place in society, who start becoming, you know, more responsible citizens and servicing their community. So there's a range of activities on our members that they do on a daily. And of course, every week they have to do their fitness test. They have to, by our BOPs also have the occupational health and safety meetings. So there's a number of activities that fulfills up their day, so to say, internally, and certainly not every day at the fire, hopefully. Ma'am, the diagram you're referring to, those things, they're not vacant posts under the GM. That is the structure that we've approved for every province, okay? The yellow ones we sort of dedicate that to get the former firefighters in. They are there. You know, so that's not vacancies per se, that's the approved structure for us to operate at a province like that. We had to table that structure at the NRM and get that approved. So that's not vacancies per se. That's just saying those posts are the posts that we develop our firefighters into as a matter of course. Okay? In terms of the model, I think I've addressed the third-party revenue, and my colleague and the DG can also maybe deal with it further. Response time. Because of the spread of our bases in the country, we have actually seen fires being tended to quicker, right? And they don't develop into larger fires as the case sometimes if it's not caught earlier. However, we do work under the auspices of the landowner and how we do it. So we've got cases where we've used aerial resources, put out a fire in 45 minutes. So it's really depending on the local situation, when the local parties are called into action, and we're obviously there to support them, and we go out. But the spread of the bases has had an impact on us being able to be at fires much quicker. We get a report on a daily basis of what the fires are, and you can see the numbers as to how they're being managed. And in the peak of the northern fire season, which is more or less now, we can have up to 87 fires a day. This season, the average has been in the upper 20s on a few days running. But so that's a relatively quiet season in terms of the fire. So the response time is really dictated by our partners who we work with. But as I said, our proximity throughout the country has meant that, are able to be there on site much quicker, you know. In terms of the SMME and BEE procurement, our contract requires us to, at the minimum of level 4 BE, which puts us a bit of a problem when you have to come to Telco, because Telco is actually a level 6, I think, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, there's some services we get boxed in a bit, but those are some of the provisions that we have to adhere in terms of procuring. Our PPC, PPE, and my finance executive can speak more to it, but we go through a competitive bidding process for that, in which all the scores, including our BEE considerations, are applied. The related parties, I think the chairperson raised the issue about related parties. In the contract, as the diagram that I showed you about the model, where there's a number of entities, separate entities, in other words, subsidiaries of the holding company, including the holding company, which was in fact identified in the contract of playing various roles. And that's where you had that umbrella in terms of strategic coordination and integration from the holding company. We have a training company which trains the firefighters and also trains other parties, rhino poaching, anti-rhino poaching personnel for the parks, etc. So there's an academy. We have an assets management company which does the fleet for the program as well as other requirements in the holdings company and outside. And then we have aviation, and our aviation company provides the services to working on fire as well as to other private clients who require the aviation services, the forensic companies, etc. In terms of the management chair, your question, the only person who is in the management of working on fire
What question were you answering about the holding company and the...
There was a question about, I think you raised it from my record here, all these different entities that service, you said, you know, what are the services that are procured via the holding company. So I mentioned aviation, training.
Yes, I wanted to get some explanation.
Okay.
About the different roles. There's a holding company that gets a management fee. Then there's another entity that provides a service. So I wanted you to explain the whole setup.
Okay. That explanation is best done if I were to go back to the... Can you just move the slide on to the structure, please?
Just to first, maybe, so that when he gives the details, Chair, I probably have outlined the understanding of the department. When you procure, when you put out a tender, the requirement says this is what you need for integrated fire management or any other service that you must provide. And the organization, those organizations, when they tender, they then say, this is what we will do, this is how we'll do it with this expertise. In the case of the working on fire, because that was the question also that was asked by the Honorable Makubele, there were schedules that when they said in their original proposal, they for you to provide effective integrated fire management, you need aviation, you need vehicles, ground vehicles, you need people, human resources, you need protective clothing and all of that. So the reason why Treasury was then involved in the process, it was to actually, when it was not qualifying, which is where I was going to start, when it was not qualifying to be a PPP, because initially we wanted a PPP as government, and it did not qualify because there are regulations in Treasury that outline what is the basis for a PPP. So then after we undertook the feasibility study, it then was confirmed we are not passing enough risk like we have in the building. We've done a number of PPPs in the department. Department of Environmental Affairs building, we did feasibility, technical feasibility, and then we said, okay, here you can pass to a private party these kinds of risks, and this is what the state would benefit. And they then use their modeling in Treasury, which is not our modeling, to then qualify it. So in this case, they say it does not qualify. However, because if you have, from a cost-effectiveness point of view, you either have a private party that comes and provides you a service, but you have no control on when they can provide that service, if they are busy doing other things. So if you then make a decision, so this is a choice that was made by government, to then say, okay, with this private party, we'll give you the money so that we deal with the risks of not having any response when we need it, okay? But we also have to lower our costs by you being allowed
to continue other business because they had the marketing arm, they were doing other things as an organization. So we said, let's look at those competencies of the organization that would apply here and what would be the fair value for government to pay or the state to pay. So the way they structured it is then in terms of the schedules, what Christo was referring to. So in the Schedule 12, it says in the PPP, in this agreement that is not PPP, the companies, it says the third-party resources and funds are considered those resources which reduces the financial burden on approved project budgets. All such additional resources must be tabled to the Working on Fire executive, including the department for approval and the value of all contributions, and then it goes further. It gives all the details. However, it gives a cap. So it incentivizes the private party to make sure that they can go and get those resources so that we are able to manage fires at a level that is required by the country, but at the same time, we don't necessarily want them to maximize on management fees. Therefore, there is here, as in number 4 on the Schedule 2, it says the implementing agent is entitled to claim a 9.6% implementing agent fees on all such additional resources available to the project. So they may not exceed 9.6%. So the AG, when they were looking at both that exceedance or non-exceedance. So the finding then that relates to what the chair, not the chair asked, I think both Ms. Edwards and chair, the finding by AG reads as follows. They, about the management concerns to possible duplication of operational costs. And they then say the agreed upon procedures, review of remuneration payments of directors of Working on Fire and other related parties. They then say procedure inspect payment schedule of Working on Fire directors and related parties to confirm whether duplicate payments were incurred. So they raised a concern, but they did not say these are the people that are paid in duplicate. What then the department has done is to ask our internal audit from the department to go and have a look. So the internal audit, then they say here, we performed analytical tests to both Kishuku Holdings and Working on Fire payroll data. We identified 11 duplications of employees, both on Kishuku Holdings and on Working on Fire payroll. The following were noted. There were 7 employees that resigned from the Working on Fire during 2016-17 financial year period and joined Kishuku Holdings. So remember when they came to the portfolio committee, there was a question that was raised about their transformation and all of that. But I'm not, now you have to answer yourselves. I'm not sure whether they were doing that by then having people that were moved to the actual holding company. And so those would then appear. They appeared previously because they were employees of Working on Fire and then finally at the... And then they say then we obtained and compared both Kishuku Holdings and Working on Fire's 12-month analysis report to verify if double payments were made to these employees. 4 of the employees that were appointed by Working on Fire for 2017-18 financial report from Kishuku Holdings and the 2 employees who resigned from Working on Fire joined the Kishuku Holdings. So they say then, based on the above mentioned, we engaged the management of Working on Fire and assess the supporting evidence pertaining to the to these matters as provided by Working on Fire. We confirmed through audit that all of the above duplications were due to resignations and employment from one company to the other. So this we still have to present to the AG because we are still planning to have a meeting with them so they can then also double check whether their concern that they were raising is adequately then responded to. So this is the information I have on the on that finding for now, Chair and Honourable Members. coming back to the deployments, so those international deployments, in the agreement that we even outlined on the annexure, they already had engagements with the U.S. when we were contracting with them. There was evidence of the different countries where they, as a company, they were active. But then as a country, recall that when we had the Canada challenge, when the report was presented here, we then, the minister, the late minister, opted that we then engage in those countries for now within the period that remains after we have signed memorandum of agreements. So we had a process through our team, the branch that is responsible for bilateral agreements. They had an engagement, and now we have a country agreement with Canada, and it would be the same. And in those agreements, they also lay out the same conditions that would align with what we have here as an agreement. So in future, I guess, again, we have a better way of handling it. But then lastly, Chair, I think your concern and the question that was raised about the future institutional arrangements and the implementation model, I think we're taking from this agreement to use as evidence for how we establish an entity. And yes, Chair, the bill is in process, but remember that when you establish an entity, Treasury must still validate your business case. So we are in that process now, and as soon as it is concluded, the bill will then be tabled after cabinet approval to this parliament. We currently are using the Biodiversity Act. However, as we were saying, even in future, cabinet had already in the discussions around the formulation of these programs on working on fire. We are called, even in MINMEX of COCTA, to then discuss the activity plan that relates to responses that support the structural firefighting. Similarly with DAF, DAF has not established any capacity, but they are in partnership with the department in respect of... So for now, within government, there is no duplication, but in future, when we have the entity, those government departments will still confirm whether they would then set up their own capacity or not. So those are the few comments that I thought I should make. Then in the last question by Chair on the directors, there was a specific question that I understood you were asking. Are there directors that are receiving salaries in the Working on Fire program and also who are directors? Or are there people who are directors in Kishugu Holdings who are also receiving salaries? What I'm establishing here now is that from the flow diagram, it's from Mr. Abrams. Sorry?
From the structure,
yes.
Yes,
from the structure.
Yeah.
Mr. Abrams is in the management structure, and he is also a director in Kishugu Holdings. Others are not directors. It's only him that is also a director in the holding company from the structure that they've presented now.
Okay. So there's no double payment?
No.
The salary
as validate.
CEO and
yes. For now,
dividends, I don't know what directors get paid.
So he will have to answer for now, but we'll validate that also because okay. I have not checked that, Chair.
Chair, I can confirm there's no double payment. In terms of being director in Kishugu.
There's
no double payment.
Okay.
By virtue of being director in Kishugu and in working on fire. I just want to address one other issue you asked about, there was a question about SME, and that I think in terms of our expenditure, honourable members, the only real substantial payer, not the only, the substantial procurement is actually PPE and PPC, as the Chair has mentioned. And that, as I've indicated, is adjudicated via a competitive bidding process and a tender. There's another range of facilities, for example, rental, which take place in, you know, the various provinces, the offices that we rent. We don't own the offices and stuff like that. And then there's
issues such as the food requirements for firefighters, but the contract actually dictates that we procure via a minimum of a level 4 BE requirement. So it's not simply SMMEs without keeping mindful of the BE component of it. In terms of the surplus, the one point I omitted to make, once we accrue a surplus, we still need to bring it to the NRM for approval for what we want to deploy it. So if we do make some money, we say we made 100, we have to come back and to the NRM Exco and say we want to deploy it. And as I've indicated, for the past 2 years, we've essentially been using that money to fund the shortfall, not to expand the program per se. Chair, your comment about the structures, if you look at the diagram that we've got on the screen here, those three arrows are the related parties which are identified in the contract, Kishugu Training Pty Limited, Kishugu Aviation, and the vehicles, which is the asset, falls under assets. Those are the three direct service providers to it. It's covered by the related parties, and it's governed by the principle of a market, competitive market rate in terms of charges, and then the holding company provides the integration of the entire program. As I said, the program doesn't stand on its own. It has a number of services which come in from the left as integrated together, but more importantly, at the bottom, there is a base partners which actually gives the form to the program in terms of where it's located throughout. I trust I've answered most of the questions.
Yes, just, sorry, Chair, Honourable Makubele was asking about the disclosure of management fees. The department can, we know what we set as management fees for all the environment programs. So what was not being done before, because they were under transfer payments, there was no requirement for that. Now that the OAG within the modified cash standards is requiring that we move these and account for them under goods and services, that we will be able to do. So whether they have not yet, as Working on Fire, sourced additional resources, we set it at 9.8 or 9.7, whatever, 9.6, whatever is in the contract, according to the maximum. And then, secondly, I think the other question was about the issue of, is it the interest, or you've already answered the income. You have answered the income question on surpluses. Surpluses, if they are not transfers, remember, for these EP programs, we were allowed by Treasury and SARS before to rather extend the benefits to the project and not retain monies. But now with MCF, we seem to be required that we will have to rather pay back if the accounting is complicated for it. So we rather than pay back to the revenue fund and not complicate the accounting for the department. And lastly, I think Honorable Yenge's question on how to achieve sustainability and benefit for rural communities, I think again here on the map that was shown, the bases are across the country. We have rural presence for firefighters north of KwaZulu-Natal, Free State, Eastern Cape, in Hawksburg, some of those areas, in Northern Cape. But, of course, there are bases that have got more capacity than others, like in Mpumalanga, which is the main offices, and also in the Western Cape. So sustainability can be achieved because these are young people who, being trained physically, can go and work and sell their services, even in other countries, by the way, because they would know better how to deal with wildfires, not necessarily structural fires. Those are the only answers that I thought were left out for me. And Guy?
Yeah, there was a... Sorry, but before Mr. Abrahams concludes, there was a question about protective clothing.
Okay. Sorry, Chair. The finding from the AG was that they looked at all the schedules that were approved by Treasury, which covered aviation, transport, and other services, but excluding the protective clothing. And Working on Fire procured protective clothing in the same fashion as if there was a schedule for it. And they were experimenting under Guy's leadership with getting them to sew locally made or produce locally made protective clothing. That was a deviation. So it had to then go back to Treasury. Subsequently, I'm informed that you have stopped that initiative as Working on Fire, and therefore they would procure protective clothing like any buying where they have to go and get quotations according to what the AG had advised. So that was a deviation, Chair. So I think that we must record accordingly. Thanks.
Dr. Preston?
Thank you, Chair. I have just three quick points. I think on that one, just to make the point that all protective clothing, where possible, is made with locally manufactured fabric and made by local companies. So that is a requirement that we have for all of our programs and certainly adhere to by Working on Fire. The second thing is with the implementation fee. I think you might have heard this before, but it's actually on a decreasing scale. So it's 9.6, but if the budget increases, the agreement actually takes the percentage lower. And then just there was a question that was asked around what people do outside of the fire season, which is actually a very important question for us. I wanted to just say that we get on our cell phones every day, we get the fires, how many fires there are and which have been fought, how many have been successfully fought. That could be certainly extended to portfolio committee members if they were interested. And one of the things that is a worrying trend is this possible link to climate change and fire seasons not being what they were. So we're starting to see more and more fires outside of what we would have thought would be the normal fire season. I don't know that we've got good statistic analysis of that, but it is a worrying trend. But nonetheless, outside of the fire season, there is, of course, the training that needs to be done, repair work that needs to be done. Trevor has talked about some of the work, the outreach work that is done. But one of the things that we're really keen to exploit is the possibility of using the firefighters to do things like high-altitude clearing, emerging species of invasives high up in the mountains where if you don't get to them soon, they become a problem, controlled burns and fire breaks and things like that these teams do. So they are certainly kept very busy. And when you look at the kind of situation that you had, Table Mountain Fire in January 2000, there were 80 structures that burnt down, all of them covered by invasive aliens like in Neisner. In the March 2015 fire, the next big fire, only 8 structures burnt down, 7 of them with invasives. The reason was not only the good work that Working on Fire does, but all the clearing work that had been done to reduce invasives, which increase the intensity of fire tenfold. So a lot of the work is trying to do preventative work, and I think we need to do a lot more work using fire as a weapon in our control of invasives. So that is what we seek to get from our Working on Fire component of the greater management of ecosystem functioning that is our mandate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Just briefly, I want us to finish now.
Just three quick ones, Chair. I just need more direct answers. One, when I asked the question in terms of the response time, to say we're responding as quickly as possible, is it 2 hours, is it 3 hours, you know, after you are informed? Yes, it depends on whoever is your...
Okay, response time.
But yeah, the other one is, Chair, the question you raised as well in terms of the 29% of the SMEs, is SME necessarily triple BEE? They needed to unpack that. It was not responded to. The third point, the accounting. I wanted to know the other DAF and the water and sanitation, do you go as well and clarify them in terms of how you spend their monies or you account to us and so on? I wanted that, those three checks.
Okay. Maybe add also the asset one. It also came on the AG's report, together with the fleet management. So if you can also respond to that. I'm worried that the asset base is quite very, very low, if I must say, compared to the expenditure on the actual acquisition of the asset. Maybe if you can also get into that as well, and then we wrap up. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. May I start with the asset question?
Yeah.
So the categories of assets that are bought as capital additions are recorded in the Working on Fire annual financial statements, and we went through a couple of those as property, plant and equipment, and consumables, etc. The asset class that I think you are referring to is perhaps the vehicle component. Sandisa has mentioned that there's a fleet of about 300 task vehicles that's dedicated to this project. According to the memorandum of agreement between the implementing entity and DIA, those vehicles are going to become the property of DIA at the end of the contract period. So during the contract...
Which contract period is when?
It expires on 31 March 2021. It started in March 2014. And that contract period was also determined on the life cycle of the fleet assets. So those vehicles are ring-fenced and listed and will become part of the asset base that's transferred to the nominated entity to DIA's choosing at the end of the contract period. During implementation of the contract, they are procured through FML, full maintenance lease, which is not recorded on the balance sheet of either Working on Fire or any of the entities associated with it. In fact, the largest component of those vehicles are leased from Absa Bank, and they are still recorded on the balance sheet of Absa Bank.
Okay.
Chair, just on the response time. The response time is almost immediate on call out because during the fire season, our firefighters are standing by to fight fires. So we've got a record. We have a dispatch and coordination from the time there's a notification until our teams get mobilized, but they are effectively standing, waiting to be called out. So
in the contract, it's 400 kilometers, 30 minutes, 200 kilometers is 60 minutes time.
Yeah.
Yes, 60 but minutes for response time.
Yeah. So in the fire season, you will find them at base even on a Saturday and a Sunday ready to go, because obviously the fires don't recognize the weekend in terms of being ready. I think we need to give the committee chair a more detailed account of the expenditure pattern. As I said, there are some fixed components of the expenditure which are set, governed by the level 4 BE, and I think we can give a more detailed account so we don't sort of just talk in generalities but specific on that. But I think more important, Chair, the question you raised about how does all these structures work together, because it's not simply the firefighters that make the Working Fire program go. And I'd like to extend an invitation to the committee to come to Nelspruit to see the academy, to see how the operation is, so that you get a feel for it, because it's very difficult to talk through the different components, how it works. I think there's nothing better than actually getting to see it. And the instant command system, how it works, how our dispatch center works. And you know, I'm sure the honourable member will invite everybody to come join us in Nelspruit at the airfield there and see us and can visit the academy. So you can actually see what we do. Academy, which was actually opened by the late Minister Bulewa. So that's an invitation, and I can say on the 7th of December we've got one graduation ceremony already. So we look forward to hosting you soon.
So, Chair, to answer directly, there is a provision in the contract that the implementing agent, where possible, must procure goods and services from service providers who have an equal or higher BEE status. So I think if we say the target currently, if they're sitting at say, about 30%, we then, as I have on the structure of the Working on Fire, we have departmental representatives that will have to relook at the targets and have that discussion within the context of the contract. So both Salim, who's from Finance, and Christo, and Neba sit in the committee, so they will have to just look at how we review the targets over time. Thanks.
Okay. Just on the fleet management, the concern was that the lease agreement is not in line with Schedule 10 of the Working on Fire MOA. What does the Schedule 10 says?
Thank you, Chair. That item relates to a standard clause in the operating lease agreement from the biggest lessor, in this case being Absa Bank, that indicates that ownership of the vehicles does not automatically pass on to the lessee. It's only upon settlement of a final outstanding amount, the residual value. And we are clarifying that agreement. Part of the improvement process on the contractual documentation is an addendum with the agreement with APSA as well, to just clarify and update that clause so that it agrees and talks to directly with the requirement of the schedule for the asset transfer management plan as per the schedule.
Okay. All right. That brings us to the end of the engagement. I think we're a little bit clarified now about the issues that we raised from this particular program. I hope that you'll be able to attend to all the issues that AG is raising in terms of the implementation of the program. But of course, this looks like there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of fully complying with the requirements of the modified catch standard. I see that the main challenge that you might have to encounter is this transfer treatment of payment, because you now pay in batches. Is it 4 installment or 3? But you give money in advance, it gets paid, and then there's accounting later, and the AG says you must pay after the service has been rendered, which it might be an issue for you going forward. But I guess that you'll be able to attend to that one. I don't know how. Through the turnaround strategy that you'll have to submit to the Auditor General. The SMME part, I think we may want to still engage a bit on that one. Maybe we must take up your challenge and come to your establishment and see what you do there.
Yeah, we'll decide, look into the program. If the program allows, we can come and see and visit. You can show us what you have there. Eh? But otherwise, thank you very much for coming. I know that you came here expecting that you are going to be seriously grilled. that's why you have prepared for us this big bundle of documents so that we can be confused and not raise any questions. Yeah. You know, when you want to confuse somebody, just give him a thick bundle of documents. You don't know where to start reading, but not with the committee. You know, we know where to go and what questions to ask. But but otherwise, thank you very much. We will then decide when to come that side. I must say, DG, this thing of environmental programs and the model, it must just be done once and for all so that you don't have to come back and fight with the DG. It's working on fire now. There's many other programs that that you'll have to resolve going forward. But otherwise, thank you very much, members. We're meeting again.